Our son was born so long ago, yet it seems like yesterday that I stood all before his crib and heard that doctor say, "You're quite a boy there, Mr. Jones." I could only answer with a nod, for in his very being there, I saw the miracle of God. Later, in his high chair, in a manner I deplore, I saw the miracle of God throw his oatmeal on the floor. Well, I fixed him something different.
And good evening. You are listening to the Scared Monkey Radio Network. My name is Ben Pretzer. We are heard on satellite virtual channel W3957. Now on kickradio.com. Welcome to all of you that are listening to the show for the first time. Of course, on Channel 46, Trust Cable in Alabama, and at scaredmonkeys.com/radio. That's where we can pick up the show live or hear podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, or whatever. Tonight on the Dana Pretzer Show, former FBI agent, president of Van Zandt & Associates, Clint Van Zandt will be here. His website is livesecure.org, and we're going to be talking about that sad Jesse Davis case. After that, Carolyn Johnson, she's the mother of a missing person, Clinton Nelson, and Barbie Kinsey will be here after that. She is the sister of another missing person, Patty Vaughn. And then a little bit later on after that, we're going to talk to Jerry from Ohio. He's one of the Scared Monkeys who helped in the search for Jesse Davis. That's tonight here on the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio.
"Choice is yours," his mother said. "You can pick the easy way. What you put into life, you'll get out of it. Each man pays his price one day." He looked up, and then he smiled. I saw he'd lost his gloom. He said, "I better look at these." He headed for his room. My son came home late one day. He seemed all worn out. I asked a little sharply what this was all about. He spoke proudly and threw his shoulders back. And in his eyes, I caught a gleam. "I wanted to surprise you, Dad. I'm on the football team." They won most of their games, lost a few. It was a thrill to watch him play. When they didn't win, we knew he'd met the challenge anyway. He didn't know it at the time, but it was a stepping stone. Solid footing for the climb to face life on his own. How those 3 years flew past. When graduation came, we saw our boy grown up at last. Our lives will never be the same. I guess we've known all along what his goal would be. From that time 3 years ago when he chose responsibility. He stood in the doorway yesterday, put out a strong right hand. I held back tears in the uniform he wore to protect his land. I shook his hand.
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. You know, you had to have been living under a rock if you haven't heard about the Jesse Davis case. It's a tragedy out of Ohio, Canton, Ohio, where a young mother, an expected mother, 9 months pregnant, had disappeared. Now allegedly a Canton police officer, former Canton police officer, her ex-boyfriend or whatever it is, it's a sad, twisted story, is charged for killing her and her unborn child. I thought I'd bring on my friend Clint Van Zandt. Clint, of course, is a author, retired FBI agent, president of Van Zandt & Associates, and talk to him a little bit about this case and, you know, why. We hear the stories, the facts, and what's happened, but the why is something, and we're going to analyze this a little bit. Hi, Clint, how are you?
Hey, good evening, just fine.
Thank you for coming on. I know you're not feeling that well, but you've been very busy, I know, on TV constantly. Like you say, you and I talked off air since Virginia Tech.
Sure.
It's been a nonstop sadness, I guess, for lack of a better term. And now we have the case of the wrestler who takes his family's life in his. And I want to focus a little bit about the Jesse Davis case, and let's talk about why.
Well, you know, there's a number of whys here. My first compelling why was, why was this guy a police officer?
Exactly.
You look at the men and women who really want to serve their community and serve their nation, and this guy, is a sociopath, a psychopath, antisocial. I think all he wanted to do was serve himself. You know, when I kind of look back, I saw a story that was written suggesting that he was hired in about in March of 2000, and at that time they had almost 100 men and women, black, white, didn't make any difference, who had qualified to be on the force. And they hired, I'm just looking at some statistics now, to hire him, even though they only hired 2, 4, 6, 7, 8, 9, they hired 10 men and women that year to be police officers in Canton. To get him, they had to dip down to number 70 out of 98 applicants, bypassing 55 other fully qualified applicants, men and women, who made much better scores than he did because the city was trying to achieve a racial balance, and that's where they had to go find him. Now, I mean, whether that has anything to do with race, I mean, it obviously does because that's how he was chosen. But when you look at his background, and that, you know, I think of Washington, D.C. As you know, I live right outside of Washington, D.C., and I remember the cloud that Washington Metropolitan Police was under because they were under such pressure to hire minorities across the board. They were hiring these guys who had clear-cut criminal backgrounds because that's who they had to hire to get them on board, or they hired them before they even did the background examination. And these guys came back to haunt them. I mean, it's a bad combination when you take a sociopath and give him a badge and a gun.
And then he's charged for giving his gun, or his gun ends up in the hands of a cousin or whatever. He's fired from the Canton Police Force, and then an arbitrator rules that he should be rehired. You know, you and I have talked before, Clint, about standards for hiring teachers in North America. What about the standards for hiring police officers? You talked about the, you know, the minority requirement and cities that have to bypass good candidates to look after that part of it. Let's talk about that and how it's turning out to be kind of a disaster.
Well, you know, it is, and yet I'm not black. I can't speak for the black experience. Were I black, I'm sure I would be demanding that black men and women be hired in any community that I live in. I demand it anyway. I think,
right.
You know, I want to see them be FBI agents. I want to see them be police officers.
Absolutely.
Across the board.
Yep.
I mean, that's part of our society. If we are going to be integrated, we have to be integrated at all levels. The challenge comes when we're hiring, when either you don't have qualified men and women, minorities, who want these jobs to begin with, and then those that apply are far less than qualified. And as you suggest, Dana, here's a guy who, I mean, I can't think of anything worse. I mean, I'm sure you and I on the job, I mean, I wouldn't let, short of a firearms instructor at the range, even touch my service weapon.
Right.
And here's a guy who gave his service weapon to his cousin, who was a convicted felon drug addict, and his cousin gets busted. And carrying the gun, the police say, "Where did you get the gun?" And he said, "Oh, I got it from my cousin, Bobby Cutts, the police officer. It's a service revolver." And he was terminated for that. He appealed it, and the appeals court went along with the termination. He appealed at one more level to an arbitrator, as you suggest, and the arbitrator said, "No, he gets his job back." And this is the same guy who got so angry that another girlfriend of his, who he had impregnated and never married, when he found out this woman was dating somebody else, he went over to her house and kicked in the front door of the house and went in again. So when you see this level of behavior, this outlaw, this as his police chief described him, as a rogue cop,
yep,
who's given his gun to a convicted felon, and Lord knows what that guy might have done with it, kicking in the door of a private residence of someone else's house, I know, to me, that is really negative retention. I mean, you and I would have been fired years ago for far less offenses as anything like that. So, you know, I think sometimes we have to revisit, number one, how do we hire, and number two, how do we retain in law enforcement? And is there an imbalance there as far as retention of officers who really shouldn't be on the street with a badge and a gun?
it's recruitment and retention, like you say. And that kind of takes me to my next question, Clint, is the police chief of Canton, Ohio has been doing a lot of damage control. Let's look at the public perception. Obviously, the media has swarmed this story like no other story. I'm going to talk to one of the searchers that volunteered to look for Jesse a little bit later on. And now the police chief is doing damage control, and I think he's doing it properly. But the public perception is seeing something like this, because the focus now is not that Bobby Cutts allegedly killed Jesse and her unborn child, but Officer Bobby Cutts allegedly killed Jesse and her unborn child. And it's tough nowadays to gain trust of the public, because we see all these negative stories. I'm curious your thoughts on that.
Well, and I think that's true, too. And there is such a responsibility in law enforcement. I'll tell a story on myself. When my youngest son was playing high school basketball, and I was at a game one night, and whatever was going on, there were fouls that weren't being called on the other team as far as I was concerned. So, you know, there was a couple of us really saying, hey, come on, you're missing these fouls. You're missing them like crazy. Well, the principal at the school came over, and he said, you know, guys, he said, you really can't yell at the referees. And he said, come on, Clint, you're an FBI agent. And I thought, you know, here I am. I've got a pair of shorts on and a T-shirt. I'm sitting in the bleachers, and yet of anybody else, I'm singled out. And I thought, rightfully so, because 24 hours a day, you're a police officer, you're an FBI agent. Well, other people don't necessarily have to carry that 24 hours a day. If you're a computer tech for IBM, someone is not going to say to you, hey, you shouldn't say that. You're a computer tech for IBM. But we do hold law enforcement, and myself and you and others, we are held to a higher standard. That's why when a police officer violates that code, that oath that he or she takes, they should be held to a higher standard. They should get a more severe penalty. They should go to prison. Because we expect, I mean, they are the thin blue line. And if they let us down, if they lie, if they cheat, if they steal, if they kill, if they let us down like that, that higher standard should be there. And we should let police officers know that they are going to get a more severe sentence than someone else who is not a police officer who would commit a crime like that. I think that's, when you take the badge, you take that responsibility.
Society today is changing, obviously. All you have to do is turn on the television, look at the internet to see. Now we have the story, the sad story of the wrestler and his family, murder-suicide. I was teasing you a little bit before we got on air that the only other person I've seen on TV more than you is Paris Hilton. And you said, well, what competition is that? But, you know, it's unbelievable as far as what's been going on here lately. Let's talk about that a little bit. There's always a story that's always a tragedy.
There is. It is man ends humanity to man. Like this morning I was on with a black Miami radio station, and we were talking about this graduate from John Jay College of Criminal Justice, a young woman who disappeared a little over a month ago. She was at a club down in Miami, and just she went in the club. There are videos of her in the club, and then she's gone. It's like Martians came down and grabbed her. And took her away, and there are just no leads whatsoever except for the person she went to the club with, and they aren't able to identify that. And then we see case after case of where, you know, women are being victimized, they're being kidnapped, they're being assaulted, they're being murdered. But, you know, an interesting statistic, I wrote a story for MSNBC.com about a week or two ago, and I think I entitled it, Who's Taking the Women?
Yeah.
And I named about three or four or five high-profile cases recently where the women, I said they're young, they're old, they're black, they're white, but they're missing. And we don't know why. We don't know what has happened to these various women. And I got a number of emails from what purported to be different mothers or sisters, and they said, you know, they said the challenge in the United States is that we look at missing women, we look at missing children, and no one looks at missing adult male. Like this one woman said, my son is 24 years old. He's been missing for 2.5, 3 years. She said, his picture has never been on television. His name has never been on the radio. It was in the newspaper the day he disappeared, and that's left. She said, why are adult males discriminated against when females and children get all of the media all the time? And, you know, I mean, that's true, Dana. Again, in the States, there are roughly about 875,000 missing persons reported every year. Now, you and I know the vast majority of those are runaways, walkaways. They eventually show up again. But there's a significant number in there that are adult males that disappear that we never hear about. Now, you know, why men are less newsworthy than women? You know, is it, Dana, because of the women and children and the lifeboat first? We figure a guy's got to take care of himself and a woman is vulnerable. Do we still have that double standard?
Yeah, no, exactly. That's exactly what it is, and it's the coverage. Let's look at the Holloway case here before I let you go. Let's look at...
I mean, that the story of Natalie Holloway, as you know, I was down in Aruba for NBC on that originally. That story never substantively changed from the day she was gone. Now, you know, there were about 20 different variations that the Calpol brothers and Joran Vandersloot told, about 20 different versions.
Yeah.
By and large, it was the three of them with her, and that still is where I think something happened to her within that, whether it was a date rape drug she had been given, and then she expired during the course of assault or something like that, and the body was disposed of. I have a hard time as an investigator ever walking away from those three primary subjects, suspects, persons of interest, acquaintances. You know, we've got all these neat, catchy terms to describe somebody. But that story never changed, and yet the media made a decision. We were going to hear that story, much like Paris Hilton, and we were going to hear it every day. Now, part of that is because a lot of people could identify, gee, you know, I mean, I've got three kids. They went off to spring break in college. Some of them had gone to the islands. So I think everybody said, gee, there but for, you know, the grace of whoever could go one of my children. We had suspects. We had, you know, islands in the background. We had friends to do talking. So all of that made it, you know, media worthy. But it's just, it's interesting today how the media makes a decision about what missing person or about what crime the world should be interested in. And then they spoon feed it to us on CNN, MSNBC, Fox. They give us the same story over and over. You click channels, you got a different talking head.
Yep.
But by and large, you got the same story again. And you wonder, and I'm part of that. And yet I wonder sometimes, you know, as sad as it is that we've got this missing woman or this situation or this child gone, there's a lot of things going on in this world that maybe that airtime should be dedicated to helping us all become, you know, better understanding of what's going on in the world as opposed to one person who's missing. But that's what we get. And evidently, people watch that data because, you know, they gather the numbers. I've had one time when I was walking into the studio at MSNBC, and I ran into Greta Van Susteren, and she was going in to do her show. And I said, Greta, you know, this is right in the height of Natalie Holloway. And I said, you know, when are we going to get off the Natalie Holloway story? There's so many other things to do. And Greta said, you know, we've kind of painted ourselves in a corner. We've run with that story. The numbers are up. The viewers are up. They're watching it. They want to hear it. And now we're kind of stuck with running that story. And I thought, that's a very interesting indictment of how the media can paint itself in a corner and now become a victim of its own creation as far as what the media should be covering.
Thank you, sir. It's always a pleasure. Your website, livesecure.org, and lots of good tips there to help protect yourself and, you know, the young single moms, the Jesse Davises and stuff out there that we need to help. We got to get the word out to them on how to protect themselves.
Thank you. Be safe.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. That's Clint Van Zandt here on Scared Monkeys Radio. We'll be right back. Here's a historic news clip for you.
...in which we can see the whole of Times Square, all the way from 42nd Street up to 47th Street on the left. This is one of the greatest celebrations that we have ever seen from the marquee of the Hotel Astor here in New York City. People, I should estimate at least 350,000 or more, it's pretty hard to estimate at this point, are cheering and screaming, making noise with sound makers, throwing confetti and bits of paper, streamers, and all sorts of things that they can find to celebrate this greatest of all victories, the surrender of the Japanese. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it's a terrific sight as we stand here and see an ocean of people. The white hats of sailors standing out predominantly in the sea of heads that we can see both to our right and to our left. And around the Times building, which of course has that terrific electric sign that flashed the news just a moment ago, I don't believe you could throw in a toothpick in down there between those people. They're packed in so tightly. The newsmen, the cameramen from all of the camera services, both still and motion picture men, are here photographing this gigantic scene as we look upon it from the balcony of the Hotel Astor here in New York City. They're grinding their cameras and people are waving flags. The vendors of noisemakers and flags have done a land office business all day long. We were over here early this morning, and at that point, people were celebrating then. But this celebration right now, ladies and gentlemen, is the biggest that we have ever seen from our vantage point right here. Down comes a cloud of papers from the rooftops of the buildings around Times Square, and the pavements below us are so covered with paper that it's difficult to see the pavement itself at places. People are steaming and teeming and pushing and shoving and going in one direction or another all around the square right now, and we think that this is really a sight. People are really genuinely happy down there. Many servicemen are among the people who are celebrating. The carnival spirit prevails all up and down Times Square. We're just told that Wednesday and Thursday have been declared legal federal holidays, VJ days. Maybe you can hear the people screaming down there, ladies and gentlemen. Let's give a listen. And that shot is just a small sample of what it was a moment ago when the Times electric sign flashed the news that everyone has been waiting for many long years. People were sitting on the curbs all afternoon on newspapers. People were perched on the fence along the middle of Times Square and perched just everywhere you could imagine, waiting for the news to come through. And now it has come through, and all of those persons who were engaged in business on any of the side streets and those who are on the adjoining avenues have all flocked to Times Square, which today is truly the meeting point of the world insofar as the East is concerned. We assume that these celebrations are being held all over this vast country of ours and in the allied nations. But just as a sample of what's happening right now, ladies and gentlemen, I can look to my left all the way up to 50th Street, and all I can see is humanity. 50th Street is perhaps five blocks beyond Times Square District. All we can see is a sea of humanity. People in every color costume, people from all of the nations of the world have assembled here today to celebrate this truly great victory over the Japanese. Police are everywhere, but they're not stopping the celebration by any manner of means. The reserves were called out late this afternoon, and they've taken posts all around Times Square, too. I don't think I've ever seen so many people in my life in one place. This afternoon, we saw many very funny things happen. People who were really in the carnival spirit of the moment, enjoying themselves to the fullest extent, throwing confetti on one another, throwing newspapers, anything that they could throw, which wouldn't hurt someone else, laughing and talking, screaming and yelling. We could hear various ejaculations of, well, now my boy can come home, and now this one can come home, and that one can come home. Believe me, it's a great thing. We see a huge electric sign up the street, which just flashed a big sign, the Japs have surrendered. And believe me, that's getting electric signs on timely and in a hurry from this vantage point in Times Square. That's all for now. This is the Mutual Broadcasting System.
Back in the WOR newsroom, we want to clarify one thing. Tomorrow and Thursday are not federal holidays, legal holidays, but they have been proclaimed 2 days of VJ observance by President Truman for the federal employees of the country. And that, of course, will mean that Wednesday and Thursday will be officially VJ days for the entire nation. We're waiting for...
Okay, we're back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. In our continuing investigations of missing persons, you know, we were talking with Clint Van Zandt here a few minutes ago, and how the media seems to cherry-pick stories. You know, we can hear about Paris Hilton for weeks and months and months and months and months. We have a young fellow by the name of Clinton Nelson who is missing, and I'd never heard of his story until here just a few days ago. Clinton Devon Nelson, his date of birth is the 9th of August, 1985. He's been missing since the 1st of September, 2006, from Princeton, Louisiana. At the time of the disappearance, Clinton was 21 years of age, male, white, 73 inches tall, 160 pounds, blonde hair, blue eyes, light complexion, glasses with round silver wire frames. Identifying characteristics are faint scars from a dog bite over the right eyebrow onto eyelid, corner of right eye, right temple, and lower jawline, scar from recent stitches on left collarbone, recently fractured three left ribs and right arm. He was wearing a black Echo brand t-shirt, blue jeans, black knit cap, new white DC athletic shoes with red trim, new black leather belt, white anklet socks, and gray bottoms. The circumstances as far as the disappearance goes, Clinton was last seen at approximately 8:30 p.m., leaving a friend's residence in the vicinity of Ward Lane and Highway 80 in Princeton, Louisiana. Clinton does have a medical condition. If you have any information regarding his disappearance, please contact the Bossier Sheriff's Department, I hope I'm saying that right, at 318-965-2203. And joining me now is Carolyn Johnson, Clinton's mom, to talk more about the case. Hi, Carolyn, welcome to the show.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine, and nice to have you on the air. Now, like I said, my first guest on the show tonight, he and I were talking about missing persons and how the media seems to cherry-pick some stories. You know, I know that we have a lot of national centers and websites that do excellent jobs trying to help find the missing, whether they're children or adults. But I'm sure, after you talking to me tonight, if you got a call from CBS that they wanted to do a story on your son, that you'd jump for joy because of the national exposure. Let's talk about that a little bit as far as your son, and then we'll get into the story. Has the media treated you fair as far as broadcasting this enough?
In my opinion, no. In Louisiana, they've run some stories on Clinton. In our hometown, they've run some stories on Clinton. But to get it out nationwide has been extremely difficult. A lot of people just really blow us off and don't take it seriously.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not sure if it's the, you know, the high profile part of the case or just the fact that the TV station or whatever in that area just doesn't want to take interest in it. That's besides the fact or the point. You're on the air with me now, and we'll give this as much exposure as we can to try and help you. Let's talk about Clinton, your son. Tell us about him. And then we'll get into the story about how you found out he was missing and go from there.
Okay. Well, Clinton had moved to Louisiana in probably the end of March, first part of April 2006. He had moved down there to get to know his biological father and spend some time with him. After being down there a couple of months, he got a job on an oil rig, and he absolutely loved the work. He was doing very well, and I was hearing all the things that moms want to hear, that their kids are doing okay, and staying out of trouble, growing up, all that kind of thing. And I had talked to him 2 days before he disappeared, and he was very excited. They were going to transfer him to Arkansas to another oil rig on what he called the Cadillac of oil rigs.
Right.
And he was excited because he'd been told that he would be a driller within 3 years, which I guess is unheard of, but he was such a hard worker, they just really expected for him to be able to move up that quickly.
Now, you're in, we won't give the exact location, but you're in the Black Hills area, and moving down to Louisiana, that's quite a jaunt. 21, I guess you're, well, I started my full-time job when I was 18 and left home. Today we hear about kids sticking around home sometimes into their 30s. That's a, you know, that's a family decision as far as when you get out and get your feet wet. Your boy was able to be on his own and survive on his own, so to speak.
Yeah, he was living in a trailer next door to his father.
Mm-hmm.
So he was getting some help, especially while he was trying to get a job and all of that kind of thing. But he was pretty self-sufficient and independent and never had any problems in that area.
Now, when we, again, it's a parent's responsibility to help their kids. I have a couple that have left home, and I'm helping them all the time, and that's just one of those things. But all of a sudden, your boy, who is doing so well, it sounds like, who is moving up the ladder, so to speak, and I know nothing about oil work, but he's moving up the ladder. Things are going really well. What happened? What all of a sudden, or was this just a total shock? Was there some problems that you knew about, or was this just all of a sudden just a big kick in the gut to you? All of a sudden, he's gone.
It was actually very surprising. Like I said, I had spoken to him 2 days before he disappeared. His father actually had called me about 3 days after he had disappeared and told me that he was missing.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been trying to get law enforcement, or claims that he was trying to get law enforcement to take a missing persons case. At that point, they were not even willing to talk to us. He actually had a paycheck, a $2,000 paycheck, sitting at his father's house.
Wow.
At a friend's house, I guess there was a party. The story says that he left the party walking home because he couldn't get a ride and just completely vanished.
The law enforcement aspect of this, I've spoken to many parents on my program who have been frustrated by the, I'm not sure if it's lack of interest or lack of understanding from whatever law enforcement agency they go to. Also that the fact that they're, it's not a 5-year-old, it's a 20-year-old. They get the, well, runaround, for lack of a better term, saying, well, they'll show up in a day or two. Let's talk about that a little bit. And how long did it take before you got some action?
It was a little over a week before they actually would take a report on it. I finally called the sheriff's office, and I said, okay, look, my son did not show up for work. He has a $2,000 paycheck sitting at home. He has had, there's been no phone calls. We cannot verify that anybody has seen him. Something is wrong.
Right.
And so they finally agreed to take the case. But I think the philosophy, at least in the beginning, was, oh, he's a boy. I was actually told at one point by one of the law enforcement personnel that, oh, he's a boy, he's probably shacked up with some girl, he'll turn up.
Mm-hmm.
And after a couple of weeks, they did finally go out and do a search on the property that Clinton was last seen at, did not find anything. And I know that the status now is a little different, but I think it took a while for them to actually believe that there was something wrong, that, you know, this wasn't just some person that had the right to disappear, as they say.
Yeah, I'm not sure if, and that's an unfair comment by law enforcement to say that the person has a right to disappear. Obviously, as a parent, you're concerned, and, you know, the huge red flag, like you say, is the $2,000 paycheck. The investigation itself, obviously, they checked cell phone records if there was any, credit card transactions, bank transactions. That was all negative. Have there been any leads?
No, not really. He didn't have any bank accounts, so there we are unable to track anything from that area. They did pull his cell phone records and were able to, trace those. There have actually been no incoming or outgoing calls since September 1st on his cell phone. Unfortunately, they didn't pull tower records, so we really have no way to try to figure out, you know, where that last call, where he may have been. Their assumption was that he was at this house on Ward Lane.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, there haven't been hardly any leads. We've had a reward out that's actually been increased to try to get people to generate information and generate leads. I know that the police have told me they believe that foul play is involved, and have theories as to what may have happened, but there's been absolutely no evidence of anything.
A theory is one thing, but evidence, as you say, is another thing. Without getting into the direct medical condition, the information I have here is that he had a medical condition. Is that been ruled out as a reason why he may have disappeared?
It is one of the possible theories. My understanding is he'd been injured at work, and they had possibly found some type of a heart condition.
Uh-huh.
And so that is one of the possible scenarios that the police have said is, you know, that something happened and, you know, he had a heart attack or, you know, quit breathing or whatever the case may be, and that he's out in the woods someplace. But I don't think that that's really what, I mean, that's not what they're telling me they believe has happened.
Now, you say you have a reward for information regarding your son. Where can people find out more information?
We actually have it listed on the Texas EquiSearch website, but it's a $12,500 reward that is put up by three different, actually my family, Texas EquiSearch, and my office have gotten together this money, and it's for information leading to Clinton's whereabouts, as well as the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible.
What is the status of the investigation? Are you in regular contact with investigators?
Probably more so than they want me to be. I call probably 1 to 2 times a week.
That's all right.
I stay in very close contact with the detective that's on the case. He's actually been very nice, and you know, for what it's worth, I think that he's done what he can. He actually didn't get involved in the case until after it was 6 months old. So I know that there's a lot of limitations because of the time frame that has elapsed as far as what he can and can't do at this point without additional information or evidence.
Well, never be afraid to bother them, because that's your right as a parent. You're looking for answers as far as your child goes, and any credible law enforcement agency will be glad to hear from you. Let's stay in touch. I'd like to have you on the show again sometime. One quick question, though, before I let you go. Was there ever a search done, a comprehensive search done?
Yes. Texas EquiSearch was out in Louisiana just before Thanksgiving and had done a search. And then we also went back, and that one was actually about a 5-mile radius. There was another search done on a smaller scale that was done probably in April, and my understanding is that we are in the process of trying to do another search and spread it out to more geography from the area that Clinton was last seen. There's about 10 miles from the area that Clinton was at to where his father lived, so it's a lot of mileage as far as being able to search the woods and drainage ditches and all of that kind of thing.
Well, stay strong. You sound to me like a lady who's got a lot of strength. At least it's strength that carries you on to get answers about your child, and we all as parents would do that, and we hope and pray that someday you'll get answers, and I appreciate you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
And we'll stay in touch. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. Here's another historic audio clip.
This is London calling. Here is a news flash. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead. I'll repeat that. The German radio has just announced that Hitler is dead.
The United States dollar took another pounding on German, French, and British exchanges this morning, hitting the lowest point ever known in West Germany. It has declined there by 41% since 1971, and this Canadian thinks it's time to speak up for the Americans as the most generous and possibly the least appreciated people in all the world. As long as 60 years ago, when I first started to read newspapers, I read of floods on the Yellow River and the Yangtze. Well, who rushed in with men and money to help? The Americans did, that's who. They have helped control floods on the Nile, the Amazon, the Ganges, and the Niger. Today, the rich bottom land of the Mississippi is underwater, and no foreign land has sent a dollar to help. Germany, Japan, and to a lesser extent Britain and Italy, were lifted out of the debris of war by the Americans, who poured in billions of dollars and forgave other billions in debts. None of those countries is today paying even the interest on its remaining debts to the United States. When the franc was in danger of collapsing in 1956, it was the Americans who propped it up, and their reward was to be insulted and swindled on the streets of Paris. And I was there. I saw that. When distant cities are hit by earthquake, it's the United States that hurries in to help. Managua, Nicaragua is one of the most recent examples. So far this spring, 59 American communities have been flattened by tornadoes. Nobody has helped. The Marshall Plan, the Truman Policy, all pumped billions upon billions of dollars into discouraged countries. And now newspapers in those countries are writing about the decadent, warmongering Americans. Now, I'd like to see just one of those countries that is gloating over the erosion of the United States dollar build its own airplanes. Come on now, you, let's hear it. Does any country in the world have a plane to equal the Boeing Jumbo Jet, the Lockheed TriStar, or the Douglas 10? If so, why don't they fly them? Why do all international lines except Russia fly American planes? Why does no other land on Earth even consider putting a man or a woman on the moon? You talk about Japanese technocracy and you get radios. You talk about German technocracy and you get automobiles. You talk about American technocracy and you find men on the moon, not once but several times, and safely home again. You talk about scandals and the Americans put theirs right in the store window for everybody to look at. Even the draft dodgers are not pursued and hounded. They're right here on our streets in Toronto. Most of them, unless they're breaking Canadian laws, are getting American dollars from Ma and Pa at home to spend up here. When the Americans get out of this bind, as they will, who could blame them if they said to hell with the rest of the world? Let somebody else buy the bonds. Let somebody else build or repair foreign dams or design foreign buildings that won't shake apart in earthquakes. When the railways of France and Germany and India were breaking down through age, it was the Americans who rebuilt them. When the Pennsylvania Railroad and the New York Central went broke, nobody loaned them an old caboose. Both of them are still broke. I can name to you 5,000 times when the Americans raced to the help of other people in trouble. Can you name to me even one time when someone else raced to the Americans in trouble? I don't think there was outside help even during the San Francisco earthquake. Our neighbors have faced it alone, and I'm one Canadian who is damn tired of hearing them kicked around. They'll come out of this thing with their flag high, and when they do, they're entitled to thumb their noses at the lands that are gloating over their present troubles. I hope Canada is not one of these. But there are many smug, self-righteous Canadians. And finally, the American Red Cross was told at its 48th annual meeting in New Orleans this morning that it was broke. This year's disasters, with the year less than half over, has taken it all, and nobody, but nobody, has helped.
And you're listening to the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio, or you can pick us up on satellite virtual channel W3957, on kickradio.com, or on channel 46 and Trust Cable in Alabama. If you want to hear podcasts of the past shows or my daily commentary, go to scaredmonkeys.com/radio. We'll be back in just a minute with Barbie Kinsey. She's a sister of a missing person, Patty Vaughn, and we're going to continue on with our stories on the missing here on the Dana Pretzer Show.
We hear a lot about war or hurricanes that hit our shore. We hear a lot about hard times and a good deal more about the crimes that make the front pages of our news. But all that does is sing the blues. about America. Now, what are the good things in our lives? About the men who love their wives, who take their kids when they go fishing, spend their working days just wishing to make things better. A fireman who climbs a tree and sets a little kitten free. A policeman who helps you cross the avenue. A man who stops when you're broken down and asks if you need a lift to town, or simply says, "Friend, what can I do?" Have you stopped at a grocery store and watched a kid who's bit off more than his 5 or 10 cent piece can chew? He needs just 2 cents or 3 to get that soda pop, you see. And you get that feeling? Why not? And you come through. And how about on a Sunday morning, the sun's up high and the day is morning and church bells break the stillness in the sky? All your neighbors and your friends climb in the family car again and go to church. Never question why. Then you look at the USA, the folks at work, their kids at play, and looking back you see how hard they've tried to keep this country free and strong. And somehow you've known all along the answer's here, right in your own backyard. For as long as you believe in love and faith, hope, God above, the future of this land of ours is strong. And most of us feel just that way, and that's the truth. So let us say, America can't be so very wrong.
All right, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Patty Brightwell Vaughn has been missing since Christmas Day, 1996. At the time, she was 32 years of age, weighed 120 pounds, approximately 5'7", hazel eyes, brown hair. Patty was last seen wearing a bracelet, a watch, and a wedding band. She may have been wearing a thumb ring at the time of her disappearance. She was last seen between the hours of 6 and 8 p.m. in or around her residence at 152 Oak Park Road in Lavernia. That's in Wilson County, close to San Antonio, Texas. Again, what we try to do here on my program is cover as many missing persons cases as possible to get the voice out and try and get some answers for the family. I do have Barbie Kinsey, who is Patty Vaughn's sister, on the air with me right now. Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you, Dana?
I'm doing great. It's nice to have you on the air. I'm looking at a picture of a beautiful young lady, Patty. Christmas Day, 1996. Boy, it's been a long time. Tell us a little bit about your sister, and then we'll get into the investigation.
Patty was 32 years old and a mother of three. And she was separated from her husband at the time of her disappearance. And she was just an incredible person. She was a very talented musician, mm-hmm. and very just an incredible mother. And she was just the light of the family. She was the one that most of the holidays centered around her home. And it's been 10 years, but it feels like yesterday to us.
I'll bet. Christmas.
We're very close.
Christmas Day, 1996. How did you find out, or when did you find out your sister was missing?
We were all together on Christmas Eve. She and the children had come to our house, to my other sister's house. We all gathered there for Christmas, and she had plans the following Christmas Day. Her estranged husband was coming over to visit the children. And then the day after that, on the 26th, she was supposed to go to our mother's house with the children and never showed. So on the 25th, we actually did not know she was missing, but we did think something was wrong because she didn't answer any of our phone calls, and we couldn't find her, you know, contact her by the phone, which was very unusual. And then on the 26th, her ex-husband, J.R. Vaughn, called my sister Kathy and said that Patty was missing.
The investigation initially, again, a small town, Lavernia. How did the police take the report? Were they helpful right from the beginning, or was it a fight from
the
family?
Well, originally, my sister Kathy and I, let me back up a bit.
Sure.
On the 26th, Patty's van was found on the side of the road, and his, JR's story was that on the evening of the 25th, that he and Patty had gotten into an argument at the house,
mm-hmm.
and that she had stormed out the door and got in her car and drove away. And we all knew that that absolutely would have never happened. She would have never left her children in a fight with him, especially on Christmas, but not on any other day. She just would not have done that. Those children were her life, and she would have never walked out without them. So the van was found on the 26th on the side of the road, 20 miles from her home. And we went to where the van was found and to call the police. And originally the police wanted us to wait 72 hours. And so we told them if they wouldn't listen to us, the media would. So
right.
we called in all three, ABC, NBC, CBS, all the local channels, the stations. And once they arrived, then the police did come. And they processed the van. And when we found the van was completely clean on the inside. And you have to understand, Patty lived down a dirt road, so this van was not clean, and she had three small children. So, in a matter of fact, on Christmas Eve, she had made the comment about that she had to clean the van soon. And I don't know of anybody who actually washes their car inside and out on Christmas Day.
Exactly.
So, yeah. So, anyway, when they went to process the van, Patty is my height. We are about the same height, 5'7", 5'6".
Mm-hmm.
And she, the seat was pushed all the way back. So that was my first clue that something was wrong. And then there were absolutely no fingerprints, no fingerprints whatsoever inside the van. And when the CSI unit went to process the van for fingerprints, the technician actually, when she kneeled, she had pulled the back door, the sliding door back, to kneel in the back of the van to process it. Both her knees got wet. The carpet had been shampooed and was still wet. So they luminoled inside the van and found they found blood inside the back of the van, behind the driver's seat. So from there, they went to the home, and it took several days for us to get them to actually go and process the home. And they called in Bexar County Sheriff's Department. Wilson County Sheriff's Department called in another county, another sheriff's department, to come in with their crime scene unit and process the house.
Right.
Which, because they didn't have the equipment. So Bexar County came in and luminoled Patty's house. And in her bedroom, behind the bedroom door, on the wall, on the floor, they found blood on the wall, on the floor. They found drag marks from the bedroom floor into the master bathroom through to the master closet. And they also found actual physical blood on the baseboards. They found blood in the mop, in the bucket. It was quite a scene that
God.
Had been cleaned up.
God, you know, with this Jesse Davis case very prevalent in the media, this must just bring shivers to the back of
absolutely.
Your neck.
Absolutely. It was... You know, I just can't imagine not only doing that to the mother of your children, but then to leave your child there
yeah.
alone for 2 days is just insane.
Wow.
That's just incredible to us.
The forensics in 1996 were different than what they are today.
It was very different. It was even today to process DNA because the crime labs are so backed up, it can take 4 to 5 months, which is exactly what it took to get the DNA results back. But we did subpoena JR and the children,
mm-hmm.
or actually the law enforcement subpoena JR and the children to provide blood samples, and those blood samples came back to show Patty's DNA. And it was actually Patty's blood that was found all over the house and in the van.
Nothing.
There was actual blood evidence in the van and in the home, and all of it proved to be Patty's.
Nothing else
and
to tie into a suspect.
The subpoena for the search warrant says that enough blood evidence has been found to believe a murder was committed in the, you know, at her address.
Were there any, again, not enough, or no blood or no forensics to tie into a suspect then?
Well, JR was the last one to see her alive. His story did not make sense. His timeline did not make sense. His alibi did not make sense. He, at the time, he said that he was, first he said he was at his sister's, then he said he went to see the minister at the church, then he said he was at his apartment cleaning it out. And it's also interesting to note that the day after Patty disappeared, he had moved all of his belongings from his apartment back into the house and changed the voice on the answering machine.
Jeez.
So, I mean, that's just odd behavior. And he never once, not one time, did he help us look for her.
Were there any, obviously there were interviews done, but were there any offers of polygraphs? I know some.
Absolutely. Yeah. He was taken in for questioning. They questioned him for 4 hours. He refused to answer any questions. He wanted a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
He hired one of the best criminal defense attorneys in the state of Texas at the time and refused a polygraph test. He was never interviewed again, and nothing ever happened to him. He took the children and moved away.
So basically the case went cold at that time.
Exactly. Exactly, because 10 years ago, without a body, it's very hard in the state of Texas to get a conviction or even, you know, to get someone to bring him in. I mean, you just can't subpoena someone just because you suspect something. You have to have a body. And they had everything but. And my argument was, you know, if they had found her, this sounds kind of morbid, but if they had found one of her organs that she could not live without, then wouldn't they have prosecuted then?
Right.
I mean, she can't live without her blood. Isn't that a body part?
Absolutely. Now, you sound to me like a very persistent lady. This is 10 years. Are you still after them to get some answers?
Well, actually, for a very long time, I have to tell you, in the very beginning, my family was so frustrated, and this took its toll completely on some members of my family. I really don't want to, you know, embarrass anyone, but we had a suicide in the family because of this. Another very, very close relative is had psychiatric attention, a lot of it. And we're, like I said, we're a very close family, but the frustration, the non-communication between our family and law enforcement for many years was horrible. We were told to sit down and shut up, and we would go to them for answers, and we would be, are you still looking? Can you do this? What about that? Can you question this person? What about, you know, because from all the evidence that they acquired from JR's home, he planned it. They had a calendar, and they had a checklist, and they had all this evidence, and, you know, we were very adamant about, can you follow up and, you know, check phone bills and phone records, and they wouldn't talk to us. So we would go to the media and say, it's Patty's one-year anniversary and still nothing, and law enforcement is not helping. Well, that didn't help our relationship with law enforcement.
No.
So for many years, we were told to sit down and shut up, which we did, and we just continued on our own. We hired private detectives. Built her website. I went to a national convention for the missing and murdered. I've taken courses with law enforcement just on how to handle these situations, and I've also learned how to handle law enforcement and the media. And in the interim, there's two new detectives on Patty's case that are. I'm sorry. Two new detectives on Patty's case that are with Bexar County Sheriff's Office that are working the cold case, and they are incredible.
Great.
And I have total trust and faith in them, and they've done just an incredible job. They've done in 6 months what no one has done in 10 years, and that is to go back from square one and question every person that should have been questioned back then. And they're going over bills and phone records and timelines and different things that should have been done back then. And they're actually making progress. And I'm really, really happy to say that I get a call at least twice a week on an update. They can't tell me what they're doing, but they do call and say, we're working on something, we're working on this, or do you remember this, or do you remember that car or this person? And so I know that they're actually very actively working on it, so I'm very happy
that
today.
Excellent. It's too bad you had to wait 10 years for it, but it's good that there's some work being done. Tell us some more information as far as the website.
Patty's website is www.findpattyvaughn.com, and her last name is spelled V-A-U-G-H-A-N.
And again, that's www.findpattyvaughn.com.
Correct. And also there are contact numbers on there. If anyone knows anything, has any information, you can get the Bexar County Sheriff's number off of there through the cold case unit. Also there's just, there's, you know, details of Patty's story and Patty's pictures of Patty and her family. For obvious reasons, we have not seen her children since shortly after she disappeared. And we were very close. I mean, we were all with each other when all of our children were born. All of our children were raised together. So to have them just disappear out of our lives was devastating, and we have not seen them. So we have, for obvious reasons, not put their picture on her website.
Right.
But we do think about them and miss them every day. I mean, they're still a part of us.
Well, we all hope and pray, Barbie, that you'll get the answers that your family so rightly deserves. And I'd like to stay in touch with you and thank you for coming on the program. Certainly.
Absolutely. And I want to thank you and your show. I mean, it's just incredible that you wouldn't believe how many people actually listen to it. And you never know what someone's going to remember or, you know, and what will come out of something like this. So I so appreciate you calling me. And I think what you're doing is a good thing, a really good thing. Families like ours are very, very frustrated. We, you know, it's amazing how many missing people are out there.
Yep, absolutely.
That, you know, it's a really sad state of affairs that that someone can just walk away and disappear out of your life, and life goes on, and, you know, a lot of people don't even know about it.
Let's stay in touch. Thanks, Barbie.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dana.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We'll be right back here on the Dana Pretzer Show with Jerry from Ohio. He's one of the scared monkeys that was involved in the search for Jesse Davis. We'll be right back. All right, we're back. This is the Dan Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Have you ever volunteered for anything? Of course you have. We all have. We've volunteered to help our kids out in school, or we've volunteered to, you know, sell tickets, or we've volunteered for something. But have you ever volunteered to help find a missing person? Have you ever volunteered to help find a body? Well, a lot of people have, and recently we've all seen the very sad case of Jesse Davis in the news media. We talked to Clint Van Zandt a little bit about it tonight, and we also saw the fine folks at Texas Equisearch being part of that search for Jesse Davis, and one of the volunteers that came down to help look for Jesse Davis is one of our own scared monkeys, Jerry from Ohio. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on the program tonight. Now, we all saw the news coverage, but what you see on the news and what actually goes on are two different things. I want to talk to you about what it's like to volunteer to be part of a search like this, what entails, you know, what you actually do as part of the search, and what do we see or what we don't see on the news media as far as what goes on. Of course, we all know about Texas Equisearch. The good people they are. Tim Miller's been a guest on my program many, many times, and of course the Holloway investigation. But you were involved in the Jesse Davis search, and I thought I'd bring you on tonight, and we could talk a little bit about that.
Okay. One of the things, we are in a community of Greendown, which is about 800 to 1,100 people.
Mm-hmm.
The township that we're in Ohio, I would imagine, I'm guessing around 18,000 in it. What happened was when they decided to form search parties, that type of thing, they asked for volunteers. We met at a the Greentown Fire Department, which is about a half mile from my house, and we began arriving there about 7 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
It took a long time to register. Where the first day, we almost didn't get started till 11 or 11:30. We had to show picture IDs and explain, why we're there, how we could help, that type of thing. Myself, I'm in a Jeep group, and we were searching with four-wheel drives. The area around here used to be basically mostly agricultural, although, no, now it's springing up with allotments, that type of thing. But we had estimated about 1,300 people showed up for the first day.
Wow, that's fantastic.
Oh, and it was unbelievable because everyone had heard about this. It had happened close to home. We don't have that many homicides that close here. And everyone wanted to think the best, that we were going to find Jessie alive and, still with her baby that was to be born, I believe, here the 1st or 2nd of July.
Right.
It turned into a body search about halfway through the first day. And Texas Equisearch and Tim Miller and his outfit, I cannot say enough good about them, Dana. They came in to this area by the request of the family, from what I understand, and they organized the search, and they got us all heading in the right direction. At the end of the first day, we didn't come up with anything. We met back at the fire department at 8 o'clock again the next morning, and this time we were out a few hours earlier, and we began the search. There's a lot of old strip mines in this area.
Right.
And one of the groups, not mine, but one of the groups was searching this old strip mine area that's now being turned into an industrial park. They found what looked for all the world like a grave. It was approximately 6 feet long, 3 feet wide, freshly dug dirt. And when we found that, the group leader radioed in to the Stark County Sheriff. The FBI was on the situation then. And they came out. They got all the volunteers and any bystanders or whatever away so as not to disturb the scene or anything such as that. And they got us totally out of view or out of range of the site. Well, as it turns out, in one way it's bad. It turned out it was a freshly planted marijuana patch.
Okay.
That's the bad part. The good part was it was not a grave where Jesse Davis was. So we ended our search that day. We had some rainstorms, that type of thing. They called it off early. And businesses and that around here donated tons of food, sandwiches, snack bars, energy drinks, water. It was just the outpouring from the food community and the commercial community was just outstanding.
If you're just tuning in, one of our own Scared Monkeys, Jerry from Ohio, is here. He was part of the search for Jesse Davis. The media circus, for lack of a better term, must have been incredible. Did it help or hinder the search?
Dana, I believe that it helped the search in the short term, but in the long term, when they began all this speculation and that, and then the rumors were flying, they were talking to people who really were not authorized to speak to them, but they were grasping onto straws. The one thing that did disappoint me out of this whole situation was that a fella from Texas and Tim's outfit came up with an unmanned drone plane that's flown by remote control. Well, this area is about 2.5 to 3 miles from the Akron-Canton Airport. This fella have the capability to search, I believe he was quoted as saying, 10 acres in like 10 or 15 minutes and get good, strong, close-up photographs of the area. And the FCC would not give permission for this plane, to this unmanned drone, to fly in the airspace around here.
What was the reason?
Well, they turned it back. There's not much that's already written up in rules and regulations in that day on unmanned drones. And so they kicked it back to the Sheriff's Department and the FBI, the local authorities, basically.
Teamwork is a big part of all of this.
I'm sorry?
I say teamwork is a big part of all of this.
Exactly. And, you know, the number one thing in everyone's mind, to my way of thinking, and I'm sure a lot of others, is let's get out and try and find this woman.
Yep.
If there's any chance that we can find her before anything dire does happen, no, let's get out and do it. Well, they were fighting over this drone thing, and the Stark County Sheriff, Summit County Sheriffs, that type of thing, they would not go on record as backing this up, which I think was really kind of a jealousy type thing on their situation, Dana. That's my own personal opinion. I think that they wanted to be the main one in control, as opposed to having someone from out of state, you know, Texas, Tim Miller, EchoSearch, that type of thing.
Right.
They could not have organized a search like Tim came in with his crew and did on such short notice. And in an area that he was totally unfamiliar with until he got here and saw the maps and that. And I think that's just, that says oodles for Tim and his group, that they can actually do that. But to not utilize all of the resources that he can bring to bear, I think that's just foolhardy. It's sort of like in Aruba with the underwater search. If Tim can round up the equipment and the manpower or whatever, he should be thankful, or they should be thankful, that he's willing to come on his own dime and do that.
Absolutely.
But I think
absolutely.
They get caught up in the local jurisdiction bickering.
Yeah, or egos or whatever it is.
Jerry,
just before I let you go, and I really appreciate you coming on tonight, how big of a shock for your small community area was this Davis case? It must have been unbelievable.
It was very much of a shock, Dana. When they found the body, they did find it, and it was in nowhere near the area that we had been searching around the Jesse Davis house and that type of thing. They found it at in Summit County, I would guess about 22 miles from here, in a park. We just learned today that the body was not buried as it had been reported. It was not in the water. It was just lying on the ground in a very out-of-the-way spot in this park. But the police officer that is now being held on for the murder, it was supposedly Jesse's boyfriend or whatever, he supposedly pointed them to where the body was. And that's how they ended up finding it up there.
Well,
it is a big shock to the community, and we're finding out so much more now about his past record before he was ever even hired onto the Canton, Ohio Police Department, that I think that's got everybody in the most shock, because he was actually able to become a police officer with a violent record and that in his past.
Yeah, if you get a chance, Jerry, listen to the whole show tonight. Clint Van Zandt and I talk about just that. Anyway, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much, Dana.
Kudos for going out and volunteering your time. And, you know, it just shows that people care. You're part of the Scared Monkeys family, and it's awfully nice to talk to you.
Hey, I'm proud to be a Scared Monkey from Ohio, Dana.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, so we got time for a call before we end up tonight. It's 1-306-842-7884, 1-306-842-7884. And I remind you, our webpage is www.scaredmonkeys.com/radio, and you'll be able to pick up a podcast of the program a little bit later on. Of course, we're on Kick Radio www.wornewsroom.com. Hope I'm saying that right. Satellite W3957 and Channel 46 Trust Cable in Alabama. It's always nice to have all of you listening. And if you're listening to the podcast after the fact, nice to have you on too. 306-842-7884. I want to thank all my guests this evening for coming on and talking about the stories that we talked about tonight, especially my buddy Clint Van Zandt, who is really under the weather, but he is always available to come on the show. Hi, you're on the air.
Dana, it's Red. Hi. How are you doing this
evening? Hi, Red. How are you?
Oh, is it Friday yet?
You know, tomorrow is my Monday. Come 5 a.m., I'll get into my, excuse the term, monkey suit. And go. Actually, I should be wearing a monkey suit right now, shouldn't I? I wonder what I could call my uniform in the morning. That doesn't matter. That's a whole other show.
I was actually calling in, I mean, based on, you know, your first interview that you had with Clint Van Zandt. I mean, I guess I need to tell you, I need to give you your service revolver back, huh?
Yeah, well, sorry, I forgot. I shouldn't loan it out like that. But, you know, look at the standards. Look at the standards and look at, you know, in my day, I'm 25 years in the job. If you swore at somebody in public, if you were a human and you lost your temper with somebody, there's a disciplinary procedure that you could lose your job. Today, somebody can have your gun and you're still working as a police officer. There's something wrong.
Well, I mean, you hate to bring some of this stuff up, which Clint certainly touched on, and being in law enforcement, you guys are much more qualified to speak to this than I am, but I really wonder if it were you, Dana, that you would still have your job.
Right.
I think people, you know, the stories that come from other unfortunate stories, I mean, you know, it's one of those cases where, you know, accidents don't just happen. These kinds of things don't, you know, just occur. This individual should have, not only shouldn't he have been a cop when he killed this girl, but he should never have been a cop.
Right.
And these kinds of things just, you know, it gives ammunition to those that want to say that all police law enforcement are this act in this manner, and we all know it's not the case, but these kinds of high profile cases certainly, you know, give a black eye to the industry, and it just fuels those people who, you know, want to say anything against authority.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Speaking of high profile cases, before I let you go, I want to get your comment on the Larry King Paris Hilton interview last night. Now, Bill O'Reilly tonight said it was the worst interview ever. And of course, Bill is Larry King's competition, but I'm ashamed to say I watched it, and I've always enjoyed Larry King, and I've liked watching his program, but boy, did that backfire on him last night.
Well, I mean, I can honestly say I did not see it live. I just couldn't lower myself to do it. I think I had, you know, paint the dryer. I was watching paint dry or something. I was doing something. I just couldn't do it.
Right.
I mean, but the idea that, you know, Paris reborn, yeah. Paris being made over, and it's so pathetic. I mean, the entire thing backfired from day one of her parents, I mean, for better, trying to whore out the story. I mean, please tell me what these multimillionaires need millions of dollars more for.
Yeah.
I mean, they threw one of their friends under the bus in Barbara Walters,
yep,
where it was going to be a $100,000 interview, of which then, you know, everyone starts denying that even happened. And then they go, you know, to the highest bidder for $1 million. And, of course, then NBC starts backpedaling on that because, you know, we all know that the media doesn't pay for news stories. Yeah, right. and then they get to the point where she's on Larry King for nothing. And, good Lord, oh, Paris Hilton didn't do drugs.
Yeah.
Really? Really? You know, I could prove that wrong with a million videos that are on the internet.
Right.
It's just it's a shame. And you had a great theme tonight in the sense that these people like Paris Hilton, and I go back to an interview that you had a couple weeks back with Eric Spinato, where he said it's the people that are interested in these stories. I don't buy it.
Yeah.
I don't buy it whatsoever. It's the media that are interested in these stories. It is producers who think they know what the people want. It's and the reason why we know this is, boy, didn't NBC and ABC pull the stories pretty quick
from
wanting to have to pay. And why do you think they did that? Because people started lighting up their phone lines and their emails, that they were out just appalled that they were going to give a billionaire heiress $1 million. I mean, you know, that just is insanity at its highest point. But then you have all of these stories with missing persons who, you know, these people would bet, borrow, and steal to get, you know, 2 minutes on the air.
Yep.
And you just look at it and say to yourself, there's a major disconnect. And I think there is much like anything, and why TV ratings are what they are these days, I don't think they get what their audience is. I mean, it's the reason why they try to put every kind of reality show on, which, you know, gets to the point of oversaturation, but they have no idea what's going on anymore. And it's unfortunate because there are so many stories, you know, that are out there. But, I mean, I know you've said this, Dina, and I've said this, and we put it out there to any family who has a missing person, who has a situation that they want to talk about. You know, folks, the TV isn't your only outlet.
Yep.
You know, more people read the internet than watch television.
Yep.
And more informed people and more people who care about going after and seeing certain stories and wanting to help, and what, as opposed to just a person who sits in front of the television and casually watches. I really wish that they would start to use the internet in the many vehicles like yourself, like what we do on Scared Monkeys and the Missing and Exploited site. These people have amazing outlets to use, and they really should start using them. I really would stress to the many families out there that they start doing this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We covered two stories tonight, and we could have covered 22 and did a five-hour show and do more tomorrow night, and there's lots of stories out there.
I mean, there are so many, Dana, and I know you're not, you would never turn down any of them.
Nope.
I mean, it's not what we do.
Nope.
I mean, you know, but I'll end with it on this one thing, and Jerry kind of touched on it a little, and he started talking about actually a major story that we're going to be covering in the future, and it had to do with the drone plane,
right,
that Texas EquiSearch was using. And we're doing a lot of background work on it right now, and the FAA should be ashamed of themselves.
Yep.
Absolutely ashamed of themselves. Wait till everybody reads that story.
Yep.
About what our beloved government is doing to help and aid in finding missing people with just pathetic,
yep,
just absolutely asinine government bureaucracy run amok.
Thank you, sir.
Take it easy, Dana. You have a great weekend.
Okay, buddy. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye. That's the top banana over at Scared Monkeys Red. I want to thank you all for listening tonight. My name's Dana Pretzer. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll see you real soon.